Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck abilities? What the fuck sticks? What the fuckadelics? What the fuckinucks? What the fuckerecans? What the fuckadelphians? What the fuck burgers? I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. Alec Sulkin is on the show today. Alec Sulkin, the comedy writer. Many of you know his work from the Family Guy. He's a big Family Guy writer. He also wrote the film Ted with Seth MacFarlane, and also he wrote A Million Ways to Die in the West. Funny guy, but it's interesting about Alec Sulkin is I don't really know him. I had not really met him, but he has a very consistent Twitter feed, The Sulk on Twitter. And I'm odd in the way that, you know, I saw his picture on Twitter and I'd read his tweets and I built a whole personality for this guy. I figured, like, I got a sense of this guy. I know this guy. He's a joke writer. But I look at the picture. I don't know how many of you do that or how many of you have this fantastic ability. I think I'm a latent control freak right under the chaos. But I sort of want to box people. I want to box people in there. How easy is it to box someone into an avatar pic? They're already in a box. And then to just assume that what they're writing and what pictures they have there or who their friends are, it's like you can completely, in your mind, encapsulate a human being. And this was a guy, I'm like, this guy's got some chutzpah. This guy has got some funny in him. This guy's interesting. He's dark. I relate to him. I believe he's a kindred spirit to me. That's what I thought when I started reading his Twitter feed. I knew he had dated Sarah Silverman. I'd heard about him, but nothing, pieces, bits and pieces. So finally, you know, we got it together and I had him on the show. I had a great conversation with the guy. He's written some funny shit. I recently saw that movie Ted and I didn't go see it in the movies because I didn't think I'd like it, but it's funny, man. And some people love Family Guy. I'm not a freak for it, but I enjoy it when I watch it. He's a funny guy and we do have stuff in common and I did have a great talk with him. So Alec Sulkin coming at you shortly. Here's what I'm learning by reading this book that I'm reading by Firestone. The Fantasy Bond. It's a clinical psychology book. Here's the deal, okay? It's very interesting to me that I have found my way in this world and that the vehicle has been this podcast because I'm a guy that a lot of people have called selfish or self-involved or, or insensitive or navel-gazing, whatever the fuck it is. There's some part of my personality that really rubs people the wrong way. It's very defined. What I'm saying is that I've been known to be difficult, intense, complicated, neurotic, angry, whatever, sad, who knows? But defined, definitely defined. So counterintuitive to that is that I found myself being known to be an interviewer of people. I'm an interviewer of people. And I don't ever think of it as interviews. I think of these as talks, as conversations. So it's very interesting to me that on one side, you've got this sad, angry, selfish, neurotic, navel-gazing, pensive, pseudo-intellectual loudmouth that has a defined personality, yet I'm known to surrender, obviously, some of that in order to talk to people. I find it interesting about me, and I'm not blowing smoke up my own ass. I think I'm being overly critical, to be quite honest with you. There are two sides to me. I've just been recently thinking about why does it work? Why does it work like that? What is it with me? So I'm reading this book, The Fantasy Bond, by this guy Firestone. Now the premise is, and I've sort of put it through to you a couple times before, is that if you have parents that are giving you mixed messages emotionally because they're trying to act like parents, as a young child, as young as two, you're absorbing that. How this woman, this man, these parents are telling me they love me, but they act like they don't know how to do that. They act like they're just saying that because they feel bad for not being able to. They act like that because they feel like they have to, because the feelings that are coming through underneath that statement are not love. They're confusing. I'm confused, 2-year-old Mark. I'm confused. So what happens is you internalize the feelings of weirdness that come from honestly reading your parents' emotions. You think, well, these are good parents. My parents are good parents. So why the weird feelings? I don't know. That must be me. That must be me. I'm fucked up. I don't feel good. I don't like myself. I don't feel comfortable. I'm paralyzed with anxiety. I'm going to die. I got no cap on my personality. And that's what you bring with you for the rest of your life. You have fantasy bonds. The fantasy bond is essentially you project a fantasy, whatever that is, that you think will comfort you, and then it doesn't. You're incapable of being comforted because you live in a world of poor self-parenting. Whatever you've had to do, you've had to survive on your own whims and parent yourself with the shoddy tools you have, because it can't be your parents' fault that you're like you are when you're that young. They're good parents. You're just fucked up. So what do you do to make yourself comfortable? You eat. You do drugs. You jerk off. You do whatever it is to soothe yourself. How do I self-parent? I'll tell you, this is the problem. How about some caffeine? How about some nicotine? How about Twitter for 2 hours? What can I stuff into my face and feel bad about? Maybe I'll masturbate today and nap. How about some actual sex with an actual person? Well, lucky I have one. She's not in this state, but we'll work it out. How about some music? I need an IV. I need a song. Give me something. You know what a great song does? A great song will jerk off your brain slowly until you finish. How do I get those juices going? What do I got to do? Because sitting with me, I just feel that weird squirrely discomfort. Oh, God, I'm a newborn in a 50-year-old body. Where's my mommy? She's not helping. So that's what I'm left with. I'm left with this weirdly kind of like uncomfortable core self that has struggled for 50 years to take care of itself relatively badly. The point I'm trying to make is that just over the chasm, and sadly the chasm that I'm talking about is I can step over it into a life of freedom and self-acceptance. I can feel it. I just need to step over this chasm. I don't know why. I don't think I can just step over it. It's literally not even a foot wide. Because I'm afraid. What's that guy look like on the other side of the chasm? Don't know. I've gotten rid of some stuff, but I mix it up. I had 15 years sober on August 9th. Thank you. 15 years sober. And now I'm getting back into sober thinking. So here's the point. I have to temper out. I have to temper some of this shit. I have to get rid of this caffeine for a little while. I got to get rid of this nicotine lozenge bullshit. I got to temper the Twitter. I got to eat a regular food regimen. I got to exercise a little bit. You know, I got to pull away from my dick. I got to really focus on the healthy elements of a relationship. I got to get back to the baseline. I got to get to ground zero of Marin to see how that fucking exists in the world. All right? I'm probably going to eat another bowl of puffins. And I might masturbate. And I will get on Twitter later. Hey, I'll kick tomorrow. Right? Right? So the point I was making about the two sides of me, the side of me that does this monologue right now and the side of me that will talk to Alex Sulkin pretty soon, is it completely honors the nature of who I am. What you're hearing in the first 10 or 15 minutes is the struggle for me to take care of myself and not be uncomfortable in the world. And what you're hearing in the second part of the show when I talk to somebody else is me completely bonding with that person as if they have all the answers. I just want to connect. I just want to connect emotionally and feel like I am soothed and excited by the life of somebody else. I want to feel their life because it makes me feel safe and happy. I guess that's interviewing. Let's talk to Alex.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Sulking. So you got a bad car.
Bad car.
And there's nothing you can do about it.
No, it's just sitting in the garage now, and I it's like I don't know what to do when things don't start, because I think I let my AAA lapse.
You did?
Yeah, I'm never, you know, I get things in the mail and yeah. They fall through the cracks, so I don't know who to call, so I just called Uber.
To fix the car?
Yeah.
Could you just come over? I'll ride with you, but take a look at it. But are you one of those people that, like, are you that way with everything? I don't know what the fuck to do with anything.
No, I don't have a green thumb or a fix-it body or anything.
Well, what's your house look like? Did someone decorate it for you?
Well, I live with my girlfriend.
So
she takes care of everything.
I know, but without that, you'd be living out of boxes,
I know,
right?
I'd fall apart. My teeth would be falling out of my head.
It's true, right?
I wouldn't.
What's wrong with us?
We're Jewish.
Is that it?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it.
But some Jews seem to manage. We're a certain type of Jew.
Those are like the Orthodox Jews. Like
what about the accountant Jews and the people that have lives? And I don't know where this breed of Jew that just entered the world with a lot of anger and creativity,
right.
Completely incapable of doing regular things.
I know. Well, do you have a good relationship with your mother? Because I do.
You do?
Yeah. She spoiled me.
Oh.
So.
I didn't get that. I'm not sure what the relationship is. I mean, I was spoiled, but yeah. I didn't feel like, it was about me necessarily.
Okay. No, it was always about me, so I never had to do anything.
So you've got that
here
mother.
I am. Yeah.
You've got the one that was there, very yeah. supportive. You could do no wrong.
Right. So, when I moved into college, she was there, you know, unpacking all my stuff. My roommate arrived and I was napping on my bed and she told him to be quiet.
Always a good start to a roommate relationship.
Right. Yeah.
So in other words, you have no, the women must be just a difficult.
Yeah, they are. There's always something wrong. As
right.
You know.
But not with us, right?
No, it's them. What's wrong with them? What do they want already? Enough.
It's weird. The reason that I asked you to come on was I think I had this adverse relationship with your Twitter feed for a couple years.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I had this relationship like, okay, that's him. That's his picture. Like, I never did any research on
sure.
you. You're just the Sulk.
Yep.
Alex Sulkin, that's his face with a mustache.
Sure.
These are his jokes. They're good jokes. And at some point I decided that guy doesn't like me. That guy, he's just this angry Jew comedy guy doing this thing. He's not even a real person. He's this one-dimensional, judgmental thing sitting in his house. Better than other people.
Well, you're right in that. That's what the way I think about other people as well.
Yeah.
So I respect your right to feel that way about me. But yeah, no, and I do feel that way about most people.
Okay, so
yeah.
I wasn't off.
No, you're mostly right there. It's just you were not ever a target of that derision. No.
And then there was one thing you wrote that like I can't get out of my head on most days. It was like one thing out of the whatever hundreds that you write. What was it? I have a bad case of dad dick today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's awful. Just terrible. Just the couple of times that you saw it in the hallway or
right,
something.
Right.
And then to see it again on yourself.
Well, it's
like,
the worst.
It's terrifying.
I mean, we all deal with age in a certain way, but there's oh, my dick is old.
Yeah.
Guy's been through a lot.
I know. And it's just not.
I put him through a lot. Other people put him through a lot.
I know. I know. And it's just not looking good today in any way. And it doesn't have. It's not 100% the dick. It's also the surrounding environs.
Oh, yeah, like yeah, sure. The paunch.
The paunch, the hair.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm everything. Not gray down there yet, but it's a matter of time.
It's, yeah.
That seems to be the last thing to get gray. Like,
yeah.
Your hair's a little gray. Your beard seems to be holding up already. But like when you get the gray down there, it's going to be like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
Everything needs help now.
But then, you know.
How old are you?
I'm 41.
Oh, okay. So you're not that old.
So, well, but we talked to our bald friends and they're like, you're
shut
so
up.
Lucky.
Yeah. Quit complaining.
I know. I know.
Mine's holding up.
Yeah,
all right.
Me too. So
where'd you come from?
Boston.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like in Boston, like Newton.
Yeah. Weston, next to Newton.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's where you grew up.
Yes.
I went to school there.
Where'd you go?
Boston University.
Oh, nice. The Terriers.
Yeah, I know nothing about sports.
Yeah, well,
you're wearing a Patriots hoodie.
I am, yeah.
It was important to you.
I do. I like sports. My mom, again, huge sports fan, so.
Wait, do you have a father?
I do. I do.
Does your mom like him? Do you like him?
I'm getting to a place where I'm good with him.
Yeah.
They're divorced.
Yeah.
So my mom doesn't like him. But yeah. I mean, they're all right now.
When did that happen?
When I was 5. So that you're understanding a lot more now.
So you have a chip on your shoulder.
I do.
Yeah. Fuck that guy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, kind of. But now he feels like he's entitled to a lot in my life, you know.
Really? Needs money, huh?
Well, it's actually not even that. I wish it was that.
Yeah.
Like, because then it would be simple, you know, write check, send check.
Yeah.
Get phone call. Thank you.
You would do that?
I would.
Huh.
But it's more like time.
Uh-huh.
You know, so he said that he did this thing just recently. He said, I want to come down there for the weekend. He came down from Wednesday to Tuesday. That was his weekend. Even my girlfriend was like tearing her hair out.
Is he retired?
From what? But yes.
He's yeah. The drifter dad.
Yeah, that's right.
You got that one.
Right.
He left and who knows what he's doing.
Right. He is retired. But to say what he had retired from is kind of a mystery.
So it's weird to me, like I guess we'll do, I don't mind a Jewish theme. I invite sure. a Jewish theme, generally. But when I was in Boston, the Boston Jewish thing is different than other Jewish things.
It is.
Like they have, I don't know if you know this, I'd like to have it substantiated, but there are several different types of rye bread in Boston. I don't know if you know this. There's Sisal rye, there's light rye, there's dark rye, and there's pumpernickel rye. Now, I don't know what delis you went to as a child or if you went
I went to a couple.
Did you go, you went to the B&H probably?
I wasn't paying attention. I mean, I went to one probably called Provisors, which was in Newton, Wobbin.
Oh, Wobbin.
Yeah.
That's very Jewish.
Yeah.
I was in love with a girl from Wobbin for one summer, and I don't know what happened to her. I met her at the Grand Canyon. We made out.
Nice.
And then I went to Wobbin when I was in high school visiting.
With high hopes.
With high hopes. Yeah. And I met her parents, and I think we made out, and that was it. Julie Janower, if you're out there.
It's now
do
Julie.
Do you remember?
No, it's now Julie Miller.
That's right. Julie Janower Miller. She's got 3 kids.
Right.
Has no recollection of what I'm talking about. So were you guys religious?
Not really, no. Definitely the least religious, what is it, reform?
Oh, you were reform?
Yeah, I guess.
Like the organ in the synagogue?
Was right.
It? Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and just going to temple like with eyes rolled like 2 or 3 times a year.
Right. And you have brothers and sisters?
I have an older sister.
Sister.
Yeah.
Surrounded by women.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. What did she end up doing? Normal things?
Yes. She is a professor at Washington University in St. Louis.
Of what?
Of international relations.
Wow.
Yeah, she's smart. Smarter than I am, much.
But do you ever go there in your brain like that? Would that have been the thing? I don't teach.
No. No, I don't think I could have. I was never, I don't think I ever got good enough grades to teach.
So you're not a wizard kid?
No.
Yeah?
Not at all.
How'd you end up in fucking show business? So you grow up, your dad leaves when you're 5.
Yeah.
And what, you visit him?
I do. He lives up north of Seattle now.
But when you were a kid, did you visit him? Or
I
was
did.
It contentious?
I did. It wasn't actually. It wasn't for a while. Like, it took me a while to realize that I was angry at him, like, till my late 20s, even.
Really?
Yeah. I was fine with him for a while, because I think I always acknowledged that it was better that he was not there.
Yeah.
You know, knowing him and knowing my mom, I just couldn't picture being raised by the two of them.
Why? What was he like?
Well, he's quick to anger, but not, you know, the Jewish anger, not like real anger where you're going to get whooped or anything. It's
just
not,
emotionally abused.
Yeah, just like his dad was kind of an asshole.
Yeah.
And so then he was, I think he tried his best, you know, and then, but I'm also totally impatient. He's completely impatient. I think he didn't have a lot of patience for marriage and me being like 5, you know. I think when I became a person, he was more into me, you know,
yeah.
When I became like someone with a personality.
Yeah, and you don't know what he did?
No, I did. I do. I mean, he went from thing to thing. For a while, he was a travel agent, which, of course, nobody sure. is anymore.
No, that's a tough racket.
Now. Right, yeah.
I'm a travel agent now.
Right, yeah. Then there was phone booth repair. No,
phone
kidding. But he was a travel agent, and then he was a travel agent for, like, a big company.
Uh-huh. Like single client?
Right.
Right, right. In-house.
In-house travel agent.
Yeah.
And then it starts to get hazy. Uh-huh. I mean, he did that for a while. Before that, he really wanted to. He owned and ran a nightclub in London after he got divorced from my mom.
I love those stories. Like the random sort of like, that was his midlife crisis.
That was what he wanted to do.
Run a nightclub in London.
And because his dad was a big into jazz. And so he wanted to do that. And he did that for about 5 years. And
really?
Then, as all clubs do, it kind of went under.
But he booked jazz?
He did.
Were you brought up with jazz?
I was, but I mean, you know, I was brought up with, they're big into swing band,
So
not like Coltrane.
Yeah,
and,
like Dorsey and
Stan Goodman and stuff like that. So that stuff I know a little bit, but the real jazz that people are like way into that's cool, I don't know.
The type that requires patience.
Right, yeah. No, I like the ones you can snap your fingers to and tap your feet.
Not the kind that makes you slightly anxious, but you feel like there's something happening.
It might get there. Yeah, no.
Yeah. So the anger thing. Mm-hmm. See, like, this is all relevant to me.
Sure.
Yeah, but you got a handle on it?
Well, no. I don't know. I mean, I fly off the handle a lot. I get angry at my girlfriend, you know.
Yeah.
She's pretty much bears the brunt of it now, unfortunately.
How long have you been together?
A little over 2 years.
You think it's going to hold up?
I think so.
So you go, you're visiting your dad,
mm-hmm.
but so he's a short-tempered guy.
Not anymore, but he was when I was growing up.
Right.
Age has dulled him.
Isn't that the gift?
Yeah.
And also the curse?
I know.
It's like right when you're sort of like, you know, I think I'm ready to take him to task. It's like he's, you know, he's having a hard time with
now,
his shoes.
Now, right. Yeah, now everyone meets him and goes, that guy?
Yeah, come
what
on.
What a sweetheart. No idea.
All your friends for years have been telling about the monster.
I love your dad.
Yeah, he's so funny.
I know.
Oh, if only they knew.
I know.
Did you ever unload on him?
A couple of times, yeah, I did. And to his credit, you know, he kind of took it and just tried to process it in the way that he could.
How old were you? Was it like a couple of weeks ago when he was here?
Coming off of it. No, it was probably like less than about 2 years ago.
I felt a mixture of bad afterwards, but also like, you know, that was 50 years coming.
Right.
I'm entitled to yell at an old broken man.
Right.
You know, at the top of my lungs for an hour.
Ugh.
It was gloriously inappropriate.
Right.
So you grew up in Weston.
Right.
What, you're the funny kid in school?
Yes. Yeah.
The disruptive?
Yep. Yeah. I was like best friends with the bully.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And diplomatic.
Great place to be.
Sure, sure. Yeah, like, yeah, I'm cool with him.
Right.
And then you had to be you had to navigate between the bully and your other friends you had to be the diplomat in that?
Well, sometimes, but often I would just watch the bully just like push their backpacks as hard as he could and just laugh.
Oh, so you were that guy.
Right.
You were the good German.
That's right. Yeah, I definitely would have been. Yeah. Path of least resistance.
Those Jews.
Yeah, I don't know. Some of them.
Yeah. So I guess you didn't have many friends, because at least everyone hates the bully, but that guy.
Right, is loathed.
That's the worst guy.
Yeah, but I was protected.
Yeah.
That was elementary school. I think in high school, I was able to kind of make more friends, kind of cross between groups. And
When did the comedy, the incentive, you're involved with, well, Family Guy is like a huge institution.
Right.
But it didn't, I mean, it didn't start there.
No. It was always something in high school. Even then, I would just write, you know, irreverent stuff for the school paper.
You did do that.
And get kind of yelled at.
You're like the Krasner of the...
Right. Yeah. But just not fully formed. It was always stuff about like, 10 people the librarian looks like, you know, getting yelled
jokes.
At.
Jokes. Yeah. But they'd publish it, and they'd be like, I don't know, this is pretty hot stuff.
Right. And I'd be like, do it.
Yeah. Okay, man, but we're not going to take the hit.
You don't have to. And so I was literally smacked across the head by our principal one time for that thing about the librarian.
He hit you?
He hit me. Not, it wasn't like a smack in the face, but it was like smack upside the head.
Like one of those parental sort of like, not punishing smacks.
Like,
but
what were you thinking kind of?
I got hit by a math teacher. I'm surprised that we share that story, because it was wrong.
Yeah.
They're not allowed to do
that. They're not supposed to.
I mean, this guy, it was out of disrespect. Like, he pointed his finger at me and said something, and I pointed at him. He was an old military guy. He just popped me with the back of his hand.
Yeah. That's not right.
I know. But, you know, it's like, it's a victory.
Right, you know, right. Yeah, you broke him.
Yeah, it's one of those lessons in disrespect. It's like, that's right, I can get through.
Yeah.
I don't owe you anything, old
that's
man.
That's right. I'm going to start looking at it that
I
way.
I think that part of having a comedic personality is knowing that you can push authoritative buttons.
Yeah,
you
definitely.
It's like the greatest thing in the world. Like, right afterwards, you feel like stunned, but then you're like, ah.
Right.
Like, I can win this.
Yes.
I won't have any friends or money.
Right. Yeah. But I got it. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, high school, irreverent stuff. Then college, did nothing. Like, no studying. Just smoked pot with friends.
Where'd you go?
Connecticut College.
What is that college?
It used to be Connecticut College for Women.
Oh, yeah?
And now
is that what drove you there?
Yes.
No.
It's true. Visiting there, it was like insane.
Really?
So the school was 65-35 women, and our class was 75-25 women.
Yeah.
So it was just like women fighting over you.
Oh, my God.
So it was kind of a terrible, great lesson.
So there's a full buffet of women to practice your specific form of malcontent on.
Exactly. Right. To target the ones who are most susceptible to that thing.
To your selfish Jewish hostility.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. In the yearbook, it says, made the most girls cry.
Right. That's right. So, yeah. And I found that was usually either other Jewish girls or Asian girls who were quiet and would say nothing.
Uh-huh.
So...
So you dated Jews. Good for you.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Did you end up, is your girlfriend Jewish?
She is.
You stayed in.
I did stay in.
Huh.
I know.
That's the one thing that you got from your mother.
True. Yeah, no, she's very excited about that.
No, they're always excited about
it. Totally excited.
I could never, my first wife was Jewish, but I think that was it really.
Yeah.
And then I had a policy against them for a while.
How long were you married?
I was married for 3.5 years. I was with her for like 8 years.
Okay.
There was some part of the Jewish middle class thing that I found, and obviously I'm self-hating in that, but I'm just sort of like, it's so predictable.
Yeah.
It's like a language of its own. I have to transcend the language.
And did you guys break up because you were fighting?
I broke up because I do a horrible joke about it. my first marriage was a disaster. I made a mistake. I married a Jew. I just let it sit there and I go, I'm a Jew. I just found that if you're a Jew and you marry a Jew, that means everything you hated about going home is now in your house.
That's great. That's awesome.
It's horrible. Like, it only can hurt her.
Right.
And, you know, and every Jew like has to think like this. Jewish couples have to sit there and go,
I
like,
know, look at each other.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But I also sometimes say that, well, that's also what makes people do it anyway, that familiarity.
Yeah.
But you become an exaggeration of yourself, you know, very quickly when you're with a Jew. You, mm-hmm. All of a sudden, you're speaking in that shorthand of like, what?
Yeah, I know.
Well, go to the place that has the thing.
I know.
You
know,
the one you like.
Totally true.
Where's that? Where do they do the eggs like that? Okay. We'll go.
Every night, yeah.
Right, and you're like, how is this happening?
I know. And in some ways, you know, as you say, it's familiar, but in other ways, it just the repetition of the same...
Yeah.
Things, you know, I tweeted once, hey, are you single? No, I'm in an endless discussion about where to eat dinner. Like, which is just what it is every time. It's like, what do you want? I don't know. What do you want? What are you craving? What do you want? It's just like every night.
And then
it's
you
the
end
same
up going
thing.
To the place, which is okay. It's never been great, but it's good enough.
And when we order in, we act like there are 1,000 places. Like, what do you want tonight out of every restaurant in LA? It's like, we order from 1.5 places ever.
But you still talk for a half hour.
Right. No.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
But see, the weird thing is I'm so attached to certain elements of being Jewish. Like, you know, I do like a good deli.
Sure.
I do. I used to really romanticize and be fascinated with old Jews. I used to work in a deli when I was in college. That's no longer there. It was in West Roxbury. Called Gordon's Deli.
Okay.
At Potterham Circle.
I know Potterham.
Yeah. You know, there's a, and there used to be in that little mall right there where the Chinese place was.
Yeah, I eat at that Chinese place.
Right.
Yeah.
Next to it used to be Gordon's Deli.
Okay.
And it was just like, I never knew. That's where I learned all about, you know, Boston Jews.
Right.
And that's where I learned that Jews could have jobs that were not necessarily that great.
Right, right. Because they were all there congregating.
Yeah, but because you're like, you remember the first time you're like a Jewish plumber?
Right.
How does that happen?
Right. What went wrong?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, so I have a real affinity for certain elements of the Jewish thing, but I guess I just couldn't see I guess it's that old Woody Allen joke. He's, you know, he's paraphrasing Groucho Marx.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the same thing, man. But you're in it.
Yep.
So, okay, so you go to college, you smoke pot, you yep. learn how to use your dick.
Right.
And then what happens?
Then, so my senior year in college, a great thing happened where I was able to get an internship at Saturday Night Live.
Oh, really?
Yes. So I, my senior year, just scheduled, made my schedule. So I had classes Monday through Wednesday, and then Thursday through Sunday, I would go down to New York on the train. You know, it was not far from Connecticut College, and just go and stay in New York and work, be an intern at Saturday Night Live.
What season was that? Who was
that?
That
was the Saturday Night Dead season, the last season with like Mike Myers and David Spade. It was like 1994 or five. And so the New York Magazine article that came out said Saturday Night is dead, and everyone freaked out. And then after that, I turned that, I became a writer's assistant the next year, which was the changeover to like Will Ferrell and Daryl Hammond and Sherry O'Terry.
Okay, but so what, how, like, what compelled you? I mean, at that, so you're in college.
So I'm in college, and during the summers, I would go into New York City and work for my uncle, who worked at a sports marketing company.
Uh-huh.
So that was basically like putting together events for, like, you know, their clients would be like Schick Razors, yeah. and they'd put together events for the NBA where it'd be like the Schick Super Hoops shoot around, you know, where they'd set up a parking
publicity
lot.
House.
Right.
Yeah.
So I worked there for a couple of summers, and one of the guys who worked there, one of the executives who worked for my uncle, used to be an executive at NBC. And he said, you know, I was getting towards the end of college, what did you want to do? I said, well, I want to get into comedy, maybe writing, whatever. He knew this woman named Evie Murray,
yeah.
who was like one of the Lornettes, uh-huh. you know, kind uh-huh. of in that blonde, lorn, like dead-eyed yeah. woman crowd.
Uh-huh.
And so he got my resume or whatever the hell it was, application at that time, to like be an intern at SNL, and I guess he got it put like on the top of the pile somehow.
Uh-huh.
So sure enough, I got it, and it was awesome. You know, it was so exciting. It was still the most exciting job I've ever had by
far. So you're like 18 or 19?
Yeah, running around the halls there. Like,
what was your job?
It was like getting people's food and like distributing, you know, script changes and running videotapes here and there, and it was great. It was wow. awesome.
And so you got to interact with the cast and...
Totally. And, you know, some were nice, some were assholes. And, yeah. like, you know, it was a great experience.
Like, what was the first asshole moment?
Well, it's funny. Most of the cast people were really nice.
Yeah.
Like, I don't remember any of them particularly. You know, some of them may never have talked or looked at me.
Right.
But, like, what this guy, and it's, I feel bad now because he's like kind of still a big to do in the world, but like he's a fucking asshole, and I'm just gonna say it on the thing. This guy Steve Higgins, I don't know.
Yeah,
if
I
know
Higgins.
Him.
Yeah, he produces Fallon Show.
Right.
He was a head writer there.
He was a head writer there when I was a writer's assistant. And he was just a dick to me. He was
yeah.
an asshole.
Yeah.
And like I always felt like watching the writers there in the room, like that was when they had like Adam McKay and yeah. different people there, and he's fucking inspired and yeah. hilarious.
Yeah.
And I just always thought that like Higgins was just a dick.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I get it. He had to like wrangle a lot of writers and do a lot of shit, so maybe he didn't have time to do his own thing. But to my mind, like his job was like to be a dick to
yeah.
me. And like, in retrospect, I realized that I also was not like a great employee.
Right.
Like I was not, I've seen enough people now come through as interns and writer's assistants and seen the kind of people who you're like, this guy's on it. He's awesome. I was smoking pot. I was there to have fun. Like I loved it there. I yeah. loved the scene. I love being a part of it.
Right.
So I realize also that like I'm a little culpable in that
sure.
thing. So he
yeah.
maybe he saw that and was like, I'm going to be a dick to this guy.
What I think is funny though, is ultimately, like when you do find some success for yourself and you look back and, you know, you decide like, well, what type of grown up am I going to be? You know, like, and it's weird that there are certain grudges or certain things that, you know, diplomatically and professionally, it's sort of like, hey, everybody's okay. You know, we're a different time and all that.
Right.
But there's some things where you're like, nah.
That fucking guy was an asshole. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah, it's true.
And then, like, you know that maybe if he hears this, he's going to call you, and you're like, oh, I don't understand. Would that happen?
I doubt that he would call me, no. And it's funny, I'm friendly with a lot of people that he's in the same world with,
right.
you know, but, yeah, he was always the guy that just rubbed me the wrong way.
He was there that when I had that meeting with Lauren that I talk about obsessively on this show with anybody who's been involved with SNL.
Yeah.
You know, and I've seen Higgins since, because, you know, I've done Fallon, I've seen him around.
Right.
And but you know, I don't necessarily know how all that. It's very hard for me to figure out, and I'm still learning about the politics of how this shit works. Because even like, I don't know if I've talked to somebody specifically about the process of writing, because obviously you ended up on your feet and you locked in with Seth and you guys did what right. you did. But you know, this weird way in, like, you know, this is some guy knew a guy who knew the girl that did the thing.
Yeah.
And then you're in there.
Yes.
And
totally.
Then, yeah. And then there's were you at that point absorbing the politics of the situation? Because there's nothing more heavily political in terms of jockeying for material, aligning, building relationships with performers and all that shit is SNL. It's like that's the school of how to.
Absolutely. And I think that I obviously saw a lot of it. It was happening right in front of me, literally. But I was so out of that fray. Like, I didn't have to worry about that
and
part
you weren't
of it.
Writing.
Right. I wasn't writing. I was just there, you know, enjoying myself.
Yeah.
And so I kind of stayed out of that, you know, part of it.
Right.
Then I was fired from being a writer's assistant, and I was replaced by Regis Philbin's daughter.
See, so
JJ
there you go.
Philbin.
You learned your lesson
yeah.
in nepotism.
Right.
You gotta
so I
know
got
a better guy.
Yeah. And apparently what happened was, and I heard about this after the fact, was that she went on Regis Live, you know, it was
yeah.
a big show. The daughter went on and addressed the camera and asked for Saturday Night Live for a job. And so
you got, like, trumped by privilege.
Totally.
And
so I've never met her, but I hate her.
Yeah.
And she's out here now, and she, like, works on New Girl, and uh-huh. like, you know, I mean, everyone says, oh, but she's so nice, she's great. I'm like, well, fuck her.
You don't know what she did to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
I didn't have a platform.
She set me back. So then what happened was,
who were you writing assistant for?
At SNL.
Just in the room.
All the writers.
Whoa, so yeah. So it was McKay. Who were the other people?
Like Tim Herlihy, yeah. Steve Luckner, Higgins. Yeah, McKay was like the main guy. I looked up to him because his stuff was so different and awesome.
Yeah. And he was already.
Oh, Steve Corin.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Dave Mandel. A lot of those guys who made huge deals and then ruined Hollywood. Yeah. You know, like.
Wait, which deals?
Well, like Mandel and Corin made like giant multi-million-dollar deals coming off of like Seinfeld's bad right. last seasons.
Right.
And then they ruined it for everyone else. Like all the writers who wanted to come in afterwards, they're like, we're not doing that again.
We're out of money.
I know. Yeah. Right. Yeah. We gave it to Dave Mandel.
We tried that once.
Right.
No bungalows available.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, it did get fucked up, didn't it? With
it
the
did.
Expansion of outlets and a few bad deals.
Like, right. Well, it's the Friends guys and the Seinfeld guys at the end.
Sure.
Who came in and took all these giant
and
deals.
Decided and decided that every writer deserved a garage full of Porsches.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they didn't make shows that hit was yeah. the big thing. And so then everyone said, well, we're not making those deals anymore.
All right. So you get pushed out by the Philbin girl.
Philbin. And then I did stand up in New York and that's where I saw you. I mean, you know, you wouldn't remember me, but you were a king already at that time. So like
96?
I would see you performing at different places.
At Luna and stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like I did see you around. I would just try
and get to as many places as I could. I was doing all those open mics, you know, Gotham and,
uh-huh.
you know, all the things that you'd go during the day and there'd
yeah.
be a line
yeah.
you know, from like 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
How was that for you?
You know, I really liked it at the time. And I knew always that I was not a great stand-up. Like, I have no energy or personality on stage. I feel like I'm a pretty good joke writer, but I don't. I have that thing where I'm like protecting myself. Where
I'm the opposite. I'm the opposite thing. I'm the exact opposite.
What,
I'm an okay joke writer, but I have a lot of personality.
You do. You do. Well, and you're a great joke writer. You have a lot of great jokes.
When they come.
I was always doing that thing of like, I'm too cool, so I'm not going to really put energy into
this
personality. It was, especially at that time, it was a type.
That was the beginning of the alt sort of like
right.
laid back.
Well, especially with like Janine Garofalo was huge then. And it's like, let's look at your notebook every five seconds. And,
yeah.
So I was doing it then. I was totally enjoying it. And there were guys like who were still at the shitty clubs then who are now huge, like Gaffigan, who
right.
I looked up to,
yep.
was awesome. And you know, like Dave Attell was coming on at that time, and
Attell
he was big.
He was
like,
a monster joke writer.
Todd Barry was there, ignoring every guy and talking to every girl.
Yeah, hey,
and so,
what's going on?
Yeah.
What's up, buddy?
Hey,
hey, buddy.
So it was, you know, it was a great time for stand ups. But again, I felt like I got in kind of a little too late.
Really?
And also, again, with the whole thing of like me not really putting a lot of energy.
Well, it's a tough racket. I mean,
it
like
is.
If you're just a stand-up, which is what I was, You know, like I never even thought about writing for somebody else.
That's all I thought about.
I could barely do it for myself. Like, it was all life and death for me. It's like, you know, I'm just trying to do this thing for me.
Right.
And all the dudes that I know that I started with that got into writing, they were the smartest ones, because they were like, all right, I got a knack for this. This stand-up thing is crazy to hang your life on that shit.
I agree.
Does not end well for most of them.
Yep.
To have that foresight, I'm very impressed with. Like Chuck Sklar, John Groff, Billy Martin. I mean, all these dudes, they became kind of huge writers for a while anyways.
Totally.
Were stand-ups.
They
were with me.
Yes. Yeah, no, I know. They're, and it seemed like the only way to go for me. So when... I did stand up for 3 years, and then they started up the Late Late Show with Craig Kilborn.
Right.
1999.
That was
early 99.
The Ferguson's now.
Ferguson is
so
now.
So this was after the Daily Show.
After his stint on the Daily Show, and they gave him the Late Late Show, and they were taking submissions for that. One of the guys who was a Weekend Update writer at SNL named Ross Abrash was a writer already hired on the Late Late Show before in pre-production.
And he remembered you from your...
He remembered me and a buddy of mine. A buddy of mine got hired first, and then my buddy said, hey, take a look at my...
Who's that?
His name's Wellesley Wild.
Yeah.
And he said, take a look at my friend Alex's stuff too. And we both got hired like within a week of each other, moved out to LA at the same time.
Are you guys partners?
We are. We are for like movie stuff. We were for a while, and then they let us split up at Family Guy for financial reasons. Like, they let us split up.
Right.
So, but we went to college together. And
at Connecticut College?
Yeah.
So he's your pot buddy?
He's my pot buddy.
And you guys like made it out.
We did.
And he made it in first and he pulled you in.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I pulled him into SNL.
What did he do there?
He was an intern when I was a writer's assistant.
Okay.
So, like, I said, hey, you got to get in on this racket.
Well, I hope Regis doesn't have any more kids.
I know, right? For God's sakes. So, we both definitely helped each other out. And I actually end up working with a bunch of people that I went to high school with and college with. And
really?
It's crazy.
Out here?
Yeah.
It just by coincidence.
You know John Viner?
Oh, yeah, I know that guy.
Yeah, of course you do. Yeah, I went to high school with him.
He's a big deal now.
And he is. Well, we write a Family Guy together, and...
I definitely know that guy. I remember him from doing stand-up in New York.
Well, I'm sure he puts you on the Mount Rushmore of comedy. Like,
but, like, someone
do.
Told me, like, he's, like, this massive guy. So he's a Family Guy guy.
He is.
And you went to high school with him.
I did.
And you weren't friends then.
No, we were. We were good friends in high school. And we used to write irreverent things in the newspaper together.
So, but you had no idea where he was at until you got out here? No.
We did stand up. We got fired. I got fired from SNL and he got fired from his normal job on the same day. And we just said, in 3 weeks, we're going to start doing stand up. Let's write an act.
Yeah, he's a nice guy, that guy.
And to give you a date, like, a lot of our first jokes were about the 96 Olympics. So that's when we started.
So you guys were writing together?
I think we didn't really write together, but we wrote separately and said, 3 weeks from today, we're not chickening out. We're going up. We went up at that place up by Columbia that's downstairs.
The West End Gate. It was Greer Barnes used to run that show.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I remember that show.
And there was some idiot guy who ran it who like ran a comedy class, and he was... terrible.
Oh, really? I
just remember instantly, like, first day of comedy, like, bonding together with my buddy and being like, this guy's awful.
I remember that guy, and that's weird now that someone brought him up. All right, so you and Wesley are writing together, and you come out here for Kilborn shows. Your first time in Los Angeles.
Right.
Are you like, what's your attitude? Like, oh, we're going to take this town by force.
Well, I think we were...
Or just another Jew.
It wasn't quite we're going to take this town by force, but I think we were happy that we were coming out here with a job.
Right.
Which seems to be an uncommon thing.
No, that's the only way to do it.
Right.
With a deal or with a job, either way, it's a gamble.
Yes.
So you were aware that you were lucky... And that, now you got to figure out what the lay of the land is.
Totally. So then we start working at Kilborn, and right away I bond with Kilborn. Like, I was the only other sports fan on staff, so we bonded over
sports.
What
happened to that guy?
Oh, my God, he made a huge mistake. He, talk about making a gamble. I think he got pissed when Conan got a huge deal, and he wanted his deal to be bigger than it was. And CBS said no, and so he walked off.
He did a couple movies.
He did.
And now he's just disappeared into anonymity?
Well, I think that he's trying to develop a TV show. I my girlfriend it works in TV and said that she had a meeting with him and that he's trying to develop a show. And
Yeah. What's he been doing?
I don't know.
It's a weird business, right?
He was so nice to me. He's so like loathed, though. Yeah. You know, I mean, but he was.
Initially he was loathed because comics thought that was a comedian's job,
right? And he's like a pretty boy sportscaster.
Yeah.
And the truth was, he was funny on the original Daily Show.
Yeah.
Like, and they had great writers and everything, and so maybe that was our failing. you know, like then you got a shit writers out there.
Writers were too good.
Yeah.
Well, you never wanted to do the Daily Show? That never came into play for you?
Or? Well, I mean, it's not.
It was already after you.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have the option to.
Right.
Like, I didn't. I would have loved to do it.
Right.
You know, but they didn't offer. I didn't apply. I think I applied like for Letterman writing jobs a couple of times, but it was when you're in your early mid 20s, the shit you're writing, it just wasn't.
But you're always a joke guy.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And so you write for Kilbourne until the end of him?
No, I got off before the ship sank. My writing partner and I, Wellesley, decided we wanted to get into sitcoms. And so we wrote a couple of spec scripts.
For what?
What are the specs?
Yeah.
We wrote a spec, Everybody Loves Raymond, where like the Sopranos came, like where it was like turned out that Ray and Tony went to elementary school together.
Was
like
that recommended to you? Or
well, it wasn't recommended, but at the time, everyone's complaint about spec scripts were they were all the same. Everybody was reading the same, you know, scripts, whatever it was at the time.
People who were trying to write actual episodes that would be on the show.
Right. And everybody's like, I don't want to read another Frasier. I don't want to read another this or that. So we wanted to write something that was attention getting. It was sort of the equivalent of the guy who writes his college application in crayon.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So we did that and it worked. We got a job.
Doesn't always work though.
It doesn't always work.
Yeah.
But we got a job on this show called The Pits.
Yeah.
That was for Fox that only aired 5 episodes. It was in 2002 maybe.
Yeah.
But it was run by this guy, Mike Scully, who ran The Simpsons and, Seth MacFarlane was on the show because it was when Family Guy was briefly canceled. So it was just lucky timing that we met him on that show. We were the same age. He liked us. He said, oh boy, if Family Guy ever comes back, I'll hire you guys.
Is he a New England guy too?
He is.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's from Connecticut. He said, if the show ever comes back, I'll hire you. And so sure enough, it did. And
that's it.
Yeah.
That's how history is made. Now that thing is an institution and people who love it.
Right.
Like it's like, it's not The Simpsons, but it's I feel like there's a war between the two or something.
Yeah. Well, I think that actually not anymore, but yes, there was. But I think that now it's interesting. We've so many of the,
you're still there.
I'm not. I went off for 1 year to work on another sitcom.
But the Family Guy thing seems to be solid. Like, you know, as long as it's like the format is solid. So, you know, you can just run writers through it.
Yeah.
And just keep...
No, it's actually in my contract with Fox that I have to go back to Family Guy.
And so, you're not upset about
that? No, it's fine. I mean, Family Guy is like a vacation. It's like there are 25 writers. So you just... You can basically buy a hammock and sit in the room all day and just
pitch jokes.
Yeah. Or take a week off. You know, I mean, it's like, it's great. It's awesome.
And Seth still runs it?
He doesn't. No, he's rarely there. He does all the voices still, but he is, you know, he's busy doing his other stuff, his movies and whatever.
Well, walk me through how that works. So, cause I'm trying to think if I've actually talked to Simpsons writers specifically about how that works. So there's 25 guys.
Yeah.
And the thing just, it makes money.
Yes.
So it's a machine.
Right.
And how does the machine work?
Well, the machine works, like the 25 writers, each one will go off separately and write an episode. Then it comes back into the room. Everybody
put it up on the board.
You put it up on the board. Then one guy goes off and writes it.
Right.
Then comes back to the room. Everybody rewrites
it. So you break the story.
We break the
story.
On
the board. And then your guy comes back with a script and you put that up on a screen and just roll through
it. Yep. Exactly right.
Yeah.
And so, and occasionally smaller rooms will break off to do the sort of jokes that Family Guy's kind of known for, those cutaway gags where it like just all of a sudden goes to, you know, somewhere else completely.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of the manpower is sort of like five people will be in another room and five people will be in a second room. And then, you know, 10 people will be in the main room and then a couple people will be off writing a script and a couple people will be off writing their outline. And
right.
So it's just it's like a conveyor belt. You right. know, it keeps going. And it takes, you know, like 16 months, I think, from the time that it's written till it airs. Just right. with all the animation and all that stuff.
Uh-huh. But how long does it take to from breaking the story to get a full script?
From breaking the story to full script is the writer gets 2 weeks, so it's a dream gig. I mean, you know, you yeah. you could have 1 week and it could be done. But
and what's the sitcom?
It's a show called Dads, which oh, yeah, is yeah, universally yeah. reviled.
Why?
People just are not into it.
Is it your idea?
It was. It was mine and Wellesley's idea. It was just to write about our dads.
And does it hurt?
You know, it didn't. It doesn't hurt because we wanted, you know, we wanted. It wasn't great that everyone hated it.
Well,
but
you were excited about this idea. You wrote this with the guy that you did. You write the movie Ted with him
yeah,
as well?
Yes.
It was a tough sell, the guy in a bear.
Well, it was tough, except it was Seth was selling it. So right. it was easier. But yeah, so. Basically, when we made a deal with Fox, you make a 3-year deal, and it's called a development deal. You hear that term all the time. So as part of a development deal, we have to develop something for them. So come the 3rd year, of course, we put it off forever.
So you were one of those writers that ruined the business for everybody.
Kind of, except our development deal didn't have the zeros yeah, that right. the other people had. Right. So we, in the 3rd year, we put it off and we said, okay, what should we do? And it was kind of like a last minute homework assignment. We're like, all right, well, let's do it about our dads. And then the thing just got fast tracked because it was after Ted, you know, we were Seth's
guys.
How'd
you come up with the teddy bear idea?
That was Seth's idea.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was totally his idea.
He pitched out the story and we just wrote it.
Uh-huh. So we came up with this idea about our dads and moving back in with us and Fox was like, oh, we love it, go do it. So we did it. Thank God, though,
because, like, you know, you don't want to be one of those people that's sitting on a deal and then, like, you get nothing.
I know.
And they got behind it.
Right.
They like the show?
No, they hate it. they hate it. The studio, you know, it took me forever to learn the difference between the network and the studio.
Sure.
But the studio loves it because they're the ones who might make money off of it.
The studio?
20th.
Okay.
And the network, 20th, yeah. hates it. So they... Put it out. Then there was a lot of furor over the pilot that it was racist.
Yeah.
You know, they said the pilot is racist. There was a joke about we put a hot Asian girl in like hot Asian schoolgirl clothing, and everybody found that very offensive all of a sudden.
Why?
It's just that idiot Guy Aoki who runs that Asian defamation league. It's like it keeps him in business to get mad about stuff. So then he got mad about this, and then everyone... It's so hard when somebody comes out and says something is racist to be on the other side of that and say, no, it isn't.
Well, you've been... It's a delicate conversation no matter what, because how do you determine on some level what is a cultural meme...
Yeah,
you know, that is established? Though it may be racist, it is not of your making.
Right.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're being racist. I mean, I guess you could call it sexist too.
You know, it was way more sexist than racist, and nobody said anything about that. It was way more sexist than racist because she was super hot.
Yeah,
and like so, it looked
so
good.
This was the pilot. They let you put on television. So you didn't see it. The network and the studio did not see it.
No,
this guy saw it.
Yeah. This guy saw it, and then everybody started complaining, oh, it's racist, it's, you know, and so then when we went to the, you know, those sort of meetings where you meet the press and they talk about your show,
that was all
anyone wanted to talk about.
And how'd you answer to it?
Well, I mean, we just said, you know, listen, we're sorry if you think it's racist. We think that the problem is that it's probably just not funny enough. You know, we think that if it was funnier, like, nobody would really care. And so... Then we just kind of that sort of put a nail in our tire at the beginning of the season, and it just slowly let air out the whole rest of the way.
Are you happy with any of the shows?
I am. Yeah, some of them were definitely funny, and the cast are funny. You know, they did a great job. I'm just at the point where I feel like, listen, we tried to do that. Maybe we'll get them the next time.
And then you just go back to Family Guy.
Go back to Family Guy and,
But that doesn't sound necessarily satisfying.
Satisfying creatively?
Yeah.
Well, it is. I mean, you get to be funny. You know, anywhere you get to be funny is satisfying. So you get to tell jokes at Family Guy.
But what would you want to do? What's the big...
Well, what I want to do is retire.
Yeah.
And never have to work again.
I'm sort of the same way.
I know.
But I don't... You know, but like when you... See, that you're in a different racket in the sense that, like, look, if you, you know, if you create a show,
right,
and you're on it a couple of years, after a certain point, you're like, well, let it go live by itself,
yeah,
and I'll just sit at home and make money while I'm sleeping.
Right. That's what I want. Or, you know, or just to, you know, we're writing a sequel to Ted. We're working on another movie after that, and I want those to do well. Maybe I can make money off of those and, yeah, say, see you later.
Yeah. But that's a big goal, just to be able to sit and...
Yeah, I bought, a couple of years ago, I bought a house on Cape Cod.
And all I wanted, town?
In a little village called Katomet. It's in between Bourne and Falmouth.
So it's way on the southern, or Falmouth?
Yeah, it's on the southern, it's like in the armpit of the, yeah, Cape. It's like right as you go over the Bourne Bridge.
When I was starting doing comedy, I did gigs all down the Cape.
I love it there.
Johnny Yee's in Yarmouth.
Nice. I don't know that place.
It's a huge Chinese restaurant with a Polynesian dance show.
Love it.
Yeah, there was Dennis was a nice town,
yeah,
right? And mm-hmm. I remember Falmouth and where there was a
Orleans,
time, yeah,
Hyannis,
yeah, Hyannisport. Gets a little dicey in the middle in the summer. It's a little, yeah, bit much. In we're in Yarmouth, I think, where it's just like people walking on the highway all day long to the beaches and
everywhere.
Yeah.
It's really crowded.
And you go get a lobster roll or a clam roll.
Love it, love it. So I'm actually going back tonight.
Really?
Yeah.
For how long?
For the week, this week, just the work week.
So you just do that?
Whenever I can.
Yeah.
And I could. It worked.
Where do you fly
week.
Into?
Boston.
And then what, you rent a car? Or you have a car at the house?
I do have a car there at the house, but I have like this car, the green shuttle, they're called, pick me up at the airport.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So now I think you're probably one of 6 or 7 of Sarah Silverman's exes.
Yeah.
Sat across from
you. Right. Join the club, right?
How long were you with her?
Like about a little more than a year.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Was that fun?
It was yeah, totally fun.
Yeah.
She was totally nice. And you,
you
know,
ruined it.
I did. I wrecked it. No, we just realized we were both two angry Jews as well. It just, you know.
And she likes to keep hers under wraps.
I know. You know, I really brought it out in her. Yeah, she couldn't hide it anymore.
You found it.
Yeah, I found it.
Your reward is we're done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it was definitely like at a certain point we were just two like angry pot smoking Jews who, you know,
angry at each other,
couldn't quite agree on, yeah, a life course.
Oh,
yeah,
my God.
Yeah.
That's fucking beautiful.
Yeah.
That sounds like a really romantic bit of business.
It was.
And now, so you're, after everything arcs out, you're successful.
Right.
And your dad, you know, comes and stays for a week.
Right.
And you're okay with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
More or less.
So you're okay with your relationship.
Yep.
And so how do you handle the anger on a day-to-day basis? Do you have any tools that I can glean?
Well, I mean, there's always prescription medication.
Okay.
That seems to help.
It does? Which one?
Well, you know, there are different things.
Okay.
There's Vicodin, sort of a fun one.
I can't do that. I'm a recovery guy, so I can't do anything that will, you know, ride the line of recreational.
Okay. Well, then you're out.
I'm fucked.
You're out.
I'm fucked.
You're angry.
Yeah. I can't do anything.
Well, do you smoke pot?
No, not anymore.
Okay.
So you still got all those things?
No. Well, actually, I stopped smoking pot like almost a year ago.
How did that change things? Were you like daily?
I started drinking more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed that. It changed that. I was a daily pot smoker. Yeah, yeah, wait, yeah.
But so, multiple. Like, why'd you stop? Did you start to get detached?
Well, actually, I stopped because my girlfriend and I were talking about like having kids.
You want pot balls?
Right. And you read differing things. Is it damaging? Is it not? But I mean, try convincing your girlfriend that.
Doesn't matter what the things are.
Yeah.
Even if there's a possibility of it being damaging.
So I described my sperm at that time as like Spicoli and his buddies pouring out of the van again, you know, in the parking lot at Fast Times. Like, that's kind of the speed with which it was all coming out. But yeah, so that was kind of the reason to.
Are you still trying to have a kid?
Yeah. We just kind of started.
Oh,
trying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
You think that'll do it?
That ought to solve everything, right? of a new thing to be angry about.
Oh, you can be your dad. Yeah. Tell me when the kid's 10.
Yeah, exactly. I'll be back.
Oh, my God. Yeah, so how did the Twitter thing blow up? Because you're one of those people they call a Twitter star.
Well, and that means nothing anymore. But yes.
Back in the day.
Huh? Yeah, 3 years ago, that meant something. Well, I think that it started just because, like, at the beginning, just the right number of, like, sort of famous people noticed me or started following me on Twitter and, like, retweeting me or recommending me. So, actually, it was a funny thing. Like, one of the writers on Family Guy is this guy named Gary Jannetty. He's hilarious. And he's gay. And his partner is this guy, Brad Goreski, who was on a Bravo TV show. Like, he was just a personality on a Bravo TV show. So he had a bunch of followers and he started following me and retweeting me. And so then I got a bunch of his followers and then somehow I got on the Twitter recommends page.
At the beginning. Right.
And then that's just
That's where you built it. Yeah. So you don't even know how many people are really even on Twitter.
Right.
There from the beginning.
Right.
But you were one of those guys, you only do jokes.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't do like, hey, come see me at this or
hey, I'm manic or why is my foot like that and
right,
whatever.
Right.
It's
mostly jokes. Yeah.
Yeah. Now and you got into a little trouble with some timing on some joke. And I think it's interesting too, even in relation to the schoolgirl shtick with the Asian girl.
Right.
Is that, you know, in a culture where, you know, we're our own big brother. And where, you know, access and immediacy is it can all happen very quickly.
Right.
You can be out of a life in a day or two.
Yes.
Depending on how the traction is handled of any particular thing.
Absolutely.
When you made the joke about, what was it, about the earthquake?
The tsunami in
Japan. The tsunami.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we're guys that are sitting at home.
Yeah.
You're barely listening to the news.
Yes, and exactly right. Like, what can I?
What's the angle?
Yeah.
And then you can't help yourself.
Right.
But they, I think that in some cases, it seems most of the time when you get flack for this.
Right.
That it really comes down to, it's usually not even it's not even racist or necessarily sexist. It's insensitive.
Yes.
And I guess that is close to ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the guys I know that get into hot water about this, they're just comics, which, you know, their moral code is certainly different than others because, you know, we're there looking for the juice.
And we come by our ignorance honestly.
Yeah. I mean, we're not genuinely trying to hurt anybody.
No.
There may be ignorance involved in terms of the cultural lexicon that's acceptable at any given moment.
Right.
But usually it's just insensitive.
Yes.
And you're sort of like, ah, fuck.
Right.
And now, you know, I guess you can't use rape at all anymore.
I know.
that word is out.
You can't say retard at all.
No more retard.
I know.
And I talk about that on stage. I did recently, which I was surprised because I try not to do it at all as even a joke anymore. But there is some, at some point, I guess you have to honor the evolution of the language.
Well, it's funny that with the thing with the tweet about the after the tsunami, like that was a thing where when I wrote it and when I was thinking of it, the thing had just happened and like the death toll was very low.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't yet this like crazy thing that was like thousands and thousands of people. I think I probably would have thought about
it differently.
And
you're thinking like, I can get the jump on the
joke.
Yes,
exactly. Yeah. And it was coming off of the Oscars where I just had such a good time like making jokes about things instantly and like, doesn't that person look like
an
idiot?
You wrote for Seth and the Oscars?
Oh, no. Well, I did, but I'm talking about the Oscars before, just at home tweeting.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like
oh,
just
right,
having
right,
like
right.
a lot of success tweeting about something as it
sure,
happened.
Sure,
you know?
Live
so,
tweeting.
Right. So that, you know, then it became this huge thing, like, you know, and again, well, the more when more people are dying, I'm at home going like, oh, God, stop dying. You're like, get
you're
out of there.
The joke.
I know. Yeah. Get away from the water. What's the matter with you? Jesus.
This joke is getting unfunny with every death.
I know.
More is you're killing my joke.
It
every
was
time
terrible. But the so I get why people were enraged about that, because I mean, when a certain number of people die, like you can't make a joke about it instantly. Like maybe in 10 years it'd be okay, but with the thing with rape and retarded, like that still bothers me a little bit. Like I'm sensitive to, you know, people who have been raped or people that are retarded or have, you know, family relatives or friends who are retarded.
I think it's, I'm not even sure what it is, mentally challenged.
Mentally challenged. You can't say retarded anymore. You can't say the word.
That's right.
It's I thought you just couldn't say it in a joke. Or
it's no longer the word.
That's not the word.
I asked an audience once, you know, what is the word? And someone said intellectually challenged. And I thought that's a little broad.
I know, right.
Who among us
is not? Those things kind of pissed me off a little bit because I just feel like that's, again, just a product of a total reactionary society that would say like, yes, of course you can't say that. Like, I don't know why, but you can't.
Well, the conversations I've had about it where like I tried to tell this story on stage once and, you know, like I think the moment that I realized how difficult it is that like I used to think like, I understand the argument about the word retard,
yeah,
and retarded,
yeah,
and okay, fine. But like I always was like sort of enamored with people who were retarded and that they had sort of a purity of spirit.
Sure.
And I was at Bumper Shoot and I was, you know, I just talked about the word retard on stage and saying that I want the word back. I would never call a retarded person a retard. You call someone who's acting like a retard.
Sure.
It's a different.
Yes.
But that was my argument, but that was dicey. And then I go to this concert. It was like Stone Temple Pilots or something. There was some guy behind me. I just heard the cadence like, Stone Temple Pilots.
Yeah,
like,
right.
And, you know, and it was like, this is too, and I turn around and there's this, you know, mentally challenged guy who's not, obviously not, he's not bad enough to not enjoy the concert or know where he's at, but he's there like doing, you know, his, that's so good. And behind him is clearly his father with just like a sort of lifelong sort of grimace of pain,
yeah,
of having this I'm sure he loves the kid and everything else, right, but it was at that moment I realized that's who that word's gonna hurt,
right? Yeah.
You know what
I mean? Yeah,
but
that's true.
And that's really what it comes down to,
right. Yeah,
I mean racism's similar but it's broader, but right, like with retarded, you know, I kind of get it, but God, yeah. We just grew up with retard.
I know. Retard was just always the thing. Like, stop acting like a retard.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And somewhere, you know, it's usually the people, I think that not unlike fag.
Yeah.
That like, you know, people who are mentally challenged have gotten retard.
Yeah.
You know, and then like, and I think that people in their families, you know, it hurts them for their kid or whatever.
Yep.
So what
well,
do we
John
do?
Lennon used to act retarded on stage.
He did?
That was like one of his big things. Like he would just always do that. He would go to like a weird sort of like,
yeah,
you know, tongue in mouth and like stamping his feet thing. He did that all the time.
Why?
Like it was funny then.
Right.
Like it was fine to do then.
I guess times change,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
Are you concerned that we'll get to a point where, you know, the parameters of what we're sort of culturally allowed to do will be so refined that there'd be no edge to any of it?
Well, I don't know, because I feel like wasn't there a time like in the 90s when all that was happening aggressively, and then I feel like it kind of abated. Like,
well, it didn't just abate. I think people fought for it. I think there was a part of the, you know, usually identified with the right wing culture that the war against political correctness, you know, sort of yielded what it yielded. But there were also comics who were not necessarily right wing. They were just filthy.
Right.
You know, and they were like, you know, we want the freedom to say whatever the fuck we want.
Yeah.
You know, Howard Stern and people like that.
Sure.
And, you know, the Dice disciples and those kind of people,
mm-hmm,
and even Kennison to some degree, were like, you know, if you can't close a door on the darkness.
Yes.
Someone's got to be in there.
Absolutely.
And I agree
with that. And I think that, I mean, listen, with the way everything's so spread out now, like just, including television and social media, like there are always going to be areas for all this stuff.
Right.
So I think that not going to go away.
Well, yeah, and also it's like just go to where you want to go.
Right.
You know,
and that doesn't mean go to a neo-Nazi like hate site. It's
no,
just
but,
like there's some. You
well,
know,
if you're going to do that, yeah, so I'm not going to hang out with you.
Right.
It's disturbing.
Right.
But you can.
Yes. And I mean, I think there are just places where, you know, where comics can say fag and like, you know, and that used to be a word also that didn't denote homosexual too. It's like,
right,
you'd say like, just stop being a retard, like stop being a fag, you
yeah,
know, like
yeah,
it's.
Yeah. And for us, it doesn't mean that, but to a gay person, they're like, well, what do you, I guess the pushback is valid in the sense that when it becomes a, you know, ethnic or gender identification things, because I've gotten in trouble for the word tranny. I'm like, really, tranny? I didn't think that was loaded.
I thought that was a technical term.
No, it's not. It's derogatory to transgender and transvestites.
Okay.
They're you know, tranny is like their fag.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting. So they're they're getting there too. Everybody's getting on the boat.
Well, yeah, but there's pushback in needs. The need for the pushback is so that group can identify itself with pride.
Got it. That's good for them. I want everyone to have pride, but I just want everyone to be able to laugh too at themselves included. I mean, like, do you think I don't get mad when people call me a kike?
I don't hear a kike much, but as a kike,
right.
you know when the tone is. Like, right. I know when someone sort of says something that, you know, is not in the tone where, you know,
right.
You fucking Jew.
Yeah.
Okay, you just said fucking Jew. But when somebody who is clearly not a Jew and is not your friend,
yeah.
You know, says, well, you know, you kind of Jewed me down. You're like, nah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if I like that. Yeah. But we're different.
Exactly.
We're running things. We're the ones with the microphones.
That's so. Right.
Yeah.
All right, it's good talking to you, man.
You too. Awesome. Thank you.
All right, folks, that's our show. I enjoyed that very much. I like Alex Holcomb. I like the guy. I like him. He's all right, that guy. You can go to WTFpod.com and check the calendar. Why don't I do that right now? Okay, I'm going to be in Red Rocks on September 7th doing the Oddball Festival. Just me and Bono, man. September 12th, I'll be at the Shoreline Amphitheater. In Mountain View, California. Red Rocks is in Denver. September 13th, I'll be at the Irvine, California Verizon Amphitheater with Oddball. September 19th, I'll be at the Jexa Energy Pavilion in Dallas. September 20th, Cynthia Woods Mitchell Pavilion in Houston, Texas. September 21, I'll be at the Austin 360 Amphitheater in Austin. November 7th, I'll be at the New York Comedy Festival in New York. Might want to get tickets to that. Selling out. November 8th, I'll be doing Comics Come Home in Boston, Massachusetts. All this is at WTFpod.com. Ooh, Thursday, Ty Siegel. I got an advanced copy of his new record, Manipulator. He's probably made 9 records since then. Guy is prolific, but this is the fucking record, man. This is where he needed to be going, man. I mean, it's weird when you hear like 9 or 10 records by a kid. And, you know, the sound just evolves, and now the production has caught up with him, and it's fucking great. Double record. Ty Siegel will be here Thursday playing great. It's a fucking, just a kid, this kid. Love him, though. Look forward to that. Ooh. I can see it. I can see over the chasm. Because it's right there. It's like it's not. I have a canyon, for Christ's sake. What would you call it? A ravine? Is it a crack? Maybe it's just a crack. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Moin, wir sind die Footballerei. Ich bin Kutsche.
Ich bin Flo.
Und ich bin Daniel.
Wir sind aber noch viele mehr. In der Footballerei gibt es American Football Freischnauze, überwiegend die NFL, in ganz vielen verschiedenen Formaten. Da ist für alle was dabei.
Das Frühstücksei zum Beispiel gibt es jeden Montag ab 5 Uhr als Podcast. In der Saison natürlich mit den ersten Reaktionen auf die Spiele des Wochenendes und in der Offseason versorgen wir dich hier mit allen frischen News aus dem NFL-Kosmos.
Dazu gibt es die bunte Welt der NFL in Kutsches Zirkus, hochspannende Kriminalfälle bei Hall of Crime und das Thema der Woche während der Saison in der Footballerei. Show.
Also, wenn dich American Football fasziniert, wirst du die große Auswahl in der Footballerei lieben. Wir freuen uns auf dich.